list, there were like two questions which related to this topic, so I'll speak about it generally a little bit, and then I'll, for the time that we have, I'll take questions from you, or feel free to contribute, because as I say, it's not going to be a, per se, a formal presentation, although I want to begin with some. Let me just say at the outset, again, due to the fact that this is an informal presentation, in these kinds of issues, it becomes very important to be as precise as possible, and both in formulation and in application. And since this is an informal presentation, so you'll just have to, you'll have to try to be as accurate as possible and understand what I'm saying as well. Slight formulation difference one way or another can often make a very big difference. So, okay, that's what I caution at the outset. Okay, I want to speak a little bit about the relationship between Chochmas Yisrael generally and Talmud Torah. This is a question which on the list, at least, I think it was related to, was brought up two or three times in different forms, but really that's what it comes down to. Whether it be the question of accuracy, of transmission and interpretation, meaning, in other words, how accurate are the things that have come down to us, number one. What about the validity of assuming that interpretations that we make in the process of Talmud Torah, let's say, do in fact reflect the intent of the Rishonim, the Amoraim, the Tanaim, that we're to which we're attributing them. Things like that, that's one issue. And obviously each of these issues really require much more treatment. I'm just going to say some general things about them. That's one question. Second question, the value of Chochmas Yisrael, meaning Chochmas Yisrael, of course, in a broad sense, which includes many different disciplines, and the attitude towards each of these disciplines should probably vary. Things like Jewish philosophy on the one hand, Jewish history on the other, and then the whole slew, the whole area of textual studies. Okay, whether that be the attempt to refine exactly the texts that we have, whether it be the Gemara, the Rishonim, the Tzviyat, etc. Or whether it be the kind of history of Halakha area, which generally attempts to determine, at least chronologically, when certain theories came about, who said what first, to what extent was the issue raised, or even possibly some of the mechanisms used or conceptions developed, the result of a particular time or a particular orientation. Okay, that question. All these, as I say, are independent questions, and each of them require very careful and very detailed discussion. But that's generally what comes under the heading of the relationship between Chochmas Yisrael on the one hand and more traditional types of Talmud Torah on the other. So, for example, just to make the point quickly, obviously, I just mentioned three or four different things. They have completely, one would approach them in different ways. If one's talking about the value of Jewish history, for example, one is really discussing the question of Hashgacha on some level. The extent to which studying of Jewish history is important from a religious perspective is another way of asking whether or not knowing the past, not so much whether it's helpful to the present per se, in the sense that it's secularly, that phrase, knowing the past is important for the present and for the future, which it is, but I mean much more than that. From a religious perspective, to what extent that really, let's say, reinforces Amunah, helps us to understand better climates of certain times, and therefore things that happen certain times, and therefore we can evaluate those phenomena or manifestations perhaps from a slightly different perspective than we would otherwise if we just have them without any kind of context or understanding. That's obviously one kind of issue. When you talk about Jewish philosophy, obviously you're dealing with a completely different type of issue. There you're dealing not so much with Hashgacha. And by Hashgacha, of course, I mean providence. But Hashgacha, right? To what extent different approaches to Hashgacha are of equal or different value? Does it make a difference who is the one who is the proponent and whether or not he was influenced by secular systems? Does the fact that the Rambam, for example, contains a great deal of Aristotelian material, and he does, Is that important? Does that somehow minimize the significance of the Rambam as a Jewish philosopher? Or on the contrary, does it enhance it, or does it simply make no difference whatsoever? What is the relationship between different systems of Jewish philosophy, those which are more, say, mystically related, oriented, more those which are purely rigorous in the sense of, or at least in the philosophy side of the Hashkafa in any case, based on a secular system of some sort, etc. I mean, that's obviously a completely different type of issue. And the third issue, which also, as I say, breaks up into many, is of a completely different nature. Namely, what is the importance of, let's say, studying texts from a secular, in a sense, secular perspective, right? Using the kind of disciplines which have been honed by secular historians and philologists, etc., to try to come up with a more accurate reflection of what it is that, in fact, is authentic, etc., or at least in its most optimum way. And these are obviously completely different issues. Let me just begin by saying that, in general, the relationship between Chafetz Chaim and Talmud Torah, let's say, in its more classical sense, is complex. And its complexity is slightly different from the complexity of the relationship between, let's say, secular studies and Talmud Torah, or Torah. And that's both in a positive and in a negative sense. Obviously, the positive is the fact that you're not dealing with a completely alien kind of discipline. You're dealing with something which relates directly to Torah, in one at least of its manifestations. In that sense, clearly the connection between the two is a closer one. And in terms of questions like the relevance, let's say, of pursuits outside of Talmud Torah and Bittulzman and things like that, obviously those problems are not as potent here. At the same time, and here's of course the rub, quote unquote, you have the exact opposite problem. By virtue of the fact that you're dealing with something which relates to the same body of information, in a sense, the dangers that you encounter, the problems that you're going to confront, are going to be geometrically even increased, because you're not only dealing here with the question of relevance and the question of value, you're dealing with the question of competing claims and rivalry. Right? Taking the same text or taking the same body of information and trying to use a different kind of discipline to yield information about it obviously raises certain problems. The question of how valid are secular instruments used on sacred texts, for example, that itself is a question. Are sacred texts as such inherently fundamentally different so that they're not subject to the same kind of disciplines by definition, let's say, that a secular text is? That's one question. But of course that's not even the most critical question. The most critical question is to what extent this kind of a discipline undermines the structure, let's say, of Talmud Torah or of Halakha. And especially in situations where it appears to collide. In other words, if such a discipline or such disciplines have certain validity, where do you draw the line? I mean, is it intellectually honest to say that, this is a question for Dabla, but I think Rabbi Lutzer raised with regard to biblical criticism in his lecture this year. But it's obviously the question that arises always. To what extent, where do you draw the line? If you're going to be intellectually honest, how do you know when you've run the course of this kind of a discipline? And on what basis do you say, that should not extend beyond this? So that, of course, is the problem. When you're dealing with, in the sense that familiarity breeds contempt, and in this case, not simply contempt, but mistrust and often rivalry, right? The whole area of Chafetz Yisrael is a much more sensitive area, in that sense, than are the whole bodies of secular studies. The secular studies would say that the parameters are more or less clear. It's clear what is secular and what is sacred. And when it comes to Chafetz Yisrael, you're dealing with secular disciplines being imposed upon sacred texts, and therefore the line is obviously much blurred. The first principle, though, I think that you have to adduce is the need for some sort of stable foundation and framework, an axis of some sort. And this for a number of reasons. I think, first of all, in any pursuit, in any discipline that you're going to pursue, you always have to have certain assumptions. You have to have certain postulates which are beyond question, or at least in a fundamental way. If you don't have them, if you don't have a basic frame of reference, basic system to start out with, then you are never going to proceed. You're never going to come to any sort of conclusion. You're never going to progress, because if you're constantly challenging the basis, there never is room to get beyond that. This is true not only for, as I say, not only for sacred pursuits, not only for religious pursuits, for secular pursuits as well. You cannot, there are certain things that are, that go beyond question, or otherwise a discipline never gets off the ground. This does not belie or undermine intellectual honesty or rigor. It simply declares that in order to accomplish anything, for effectiveness, we sometimes yield to, we often have to sacrifice not total intellectual honesty, but I would say an unrestricted inquiry. It's just impossible to proceed. But that's true generally, I think, in all secular pursuits as well as religious pursuits. But it's particularly true in a religious quest. Because in a religious quest, you always have to consider, not just consider, you have to assert with, you know, positively, the fact that the anchor has to be divine. What makes a religious pursuit different from a secular one is not only the information itself, not only the fact that it's prescriptive and imposes upon you certain obligations and imperatives, but the idea that this is not something that's arbitrary, right? The fact that it is different, the fact that it is divinely rooted. Something which is divinely rooted obviously does not require man's validation, and if it doesn't require man's validation, then it makes more, it makes even more sense than in a regular pursuit that you're going to have a set of axioms and a set of assumptions which are going to be unchallengeable. Without that, you basically do not have a sacred pursuit. You never can have one. So that, if this is true generally, it's more true specifically here. And take it a step beyond that, it's more true for halakha than it is for any other religion. That because, of course, it's strong emphasis on Mesorah and on Torah Sheba'al Peh. The very notion that 85% of what we have is not rooted in a text, or at least in a sacred text, sacred in the sense of divine text, put it that way, but is the product of Mesorah. The whole notion, and it's not only in the history of religions, in this sense, the whole notion of Torah Sheba'al Peh, to the extent that we, not the notion that there is a concept of Mesorah, but the Hatkila notion of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, which declares that it's not only a reality, not only a burden or a necessary reality, but on the contrary, that this is the ideal, right? The whole notion that Dvarim Sheba'al Peh, the Hatkila at least, are Iyashar L'Koslam, for that reason, the whole notion that it should be transmitted through Torah Sheba'al Peh, because that somehow contributes to the system itself, that's very unique in the history of religion. And but because that's not only a factor, but an indispensable force in our thought system, and it is, Torah Sheba'al Peh is probably the most dominant theme that we have, that of course determines that this notion of having a clear divine anchor, or an anchor which is beyond question, which is based on Mesorah, obviously is the truth of that statement with regard to Yahadus then is going to be completely manifest. Even if you would attempt to challenge it with regard to other religions, and certainly with regard to other disciplines. Of course, again, I emphasize this doesn't in any way interfere with the notion of rigor, analysis, even initiative, even the notion, I mean, the whole notion of chiddush, the idea that one should be creative in learning, that one should be rigorous. This, of course, is also an indispensable part of the system. The whole notion of makom shemakom yinichu lehizgader bo and lo v'shamayim, and the idea of chiddush of, you know, omer davar b'shem amro, right, which basically admits the possibility that somebody is creative and that a particular idea should be attributed to a particular individual. It's not simply you know, something which is part of the system, although it is part of the system. That's really the dialectic. The idea that something can be latent in the system and a legitimate interpretation of it, and therefore part of Shivim Panim LaTorah, part of Eilu Ve'eilu Dibra LeKim Chayim, and yet something which was discovered in some sense, right, quotation marks around the word, discovered by a particular individual at a particular time. So that motion kiddush, and that idea of autonomy or initiative, is not something which is belied by the admission that there is a structure which is beyond refutation, beyond question, beyond challenge. On the contrary, it just simply means that you have to work within the system, within the structure, within that framework, in order for your initiative and your creativity and your autonomy to be a legitimate expression of Torah. And that, of course, is something which is also implicit in the notion of Kol Ma'aseh, Talmud Basak, Asa Tachadesh, Ne'emar L'Moshe Mi'Sinai, etc. The idea, in other words, that you can have this what on the surface looks like a contradiction, notion of independence and initiative within a revealed and pre-existing system. That's really one of the mechanisms that you have, which attempt really to reconcile that tension, that dialogue. So that's the first assumption that you have to make with regard to these kinds of issues. And I think the conclusion, at least with regard to this issue, is that fundamentally the Masorah that we have is not only something that we live with, because b'di'eved we have no further corroboration, but that the whole idea of Masorah itself, l'chatkila, is a l'chatkila, and it's something which is indispensable to the system itself. Again, as I say, both in terms of creating a conducive climate for creativity and initiative in a sense, right? Obviously something which is fixed in the text and in a very limited way is something which is much less open to development. And again, by development, that's one of those dangerous words. By development, I mean not artificial creation, not artificial creation which doesn't correspond to truth. What I mean is within this tension of the ability to uncover that which already is there, or that which conceivably is a legitimate expression of that which is there. So that's one aspect, and therefore I think in a discussion of this sort, the idea of Masorah, it has to be understood that that's a l'chatkhila, and that's something that we rely on not simply as a, without any other recourse, but something which we believe to be true, which we have faith in, complete faith in, and which is desirous, because it enhances and contributes to the other important facets of the system. Now, if that is true generally, in terms of the accuracy of information, well, let me just say one other thing. That, of course, does not mean that it's impossible for inaccurate information to filter into the system. Okay? It does not mean that. Obviously, no one is going to deny the fact that human beings are human, prone to error, and even when they deal in the area of the sacred, it's possible that they made mistakes. I mean, there is no question about that. The question, however, becomes, what is the significance of that, and whether or not it's covered by the system itself? In other words, it's one thing to say that an occasional mistake can creep into a Masorah. It's quite another thing to say that the very notion of Masorah implies the possibility of human error with regard to everything that you're... No, it implies that a critical stance, and critical again in the sense of challenging the validity of the accuracy of the transmission, not critical in the sense of analyzing its meaning and determining its application. But again, those are two completely different things. To say that because we're dealing with Masorah, which has been deposited in human hands, and therefore everything that I face, every fact that I encounter, I should encounter critically, that's one stance. That's probably not a stance which is acceptable from our perspective. But that doesn't mean that on occasion it's possible that a particular detail, or at least some aspect of the transmission of that detail, was inaccurately transmitted. That's conceivable. Now, but even then, one has to explain what exactly is meant by that and what the significance of that is. In other words, number one, if I say, for example, that something has been reported in the name of Rava, okay, and I come up tomorrow with clear-cut evidence that Rava never said it, Rava never knew of it, Rava wasn't even living at the time it was, at the time that this particular issue was raised, that maybe it's conceivable that such a thing could happen. Does that therefore call into question the entire system? The answer is definitely not. All it means is that a particular attribution is incorrect. Instead of attributing it to Rabbah, I heard it wrong. It should have been introduced to, it should have been attributed to somebody else, Rebbe. And let's give you an example. Obviously, that's the most innocuous of the examples. There are other examples which are more problematic, right? Not simply wrong attribution to a particular individual. And incidentally, the reason I give you that example, because those are the probably the most common examples in terms of, if you talk about certain areas of Chochmas Yisrael, the ones that are very aggressive and that suggest that Chochmas Yisrael is a, and I'll get this in a few moments, is a viable alternative to, let's say, classical means of classical approach to Talmud Torah, the most frequent evidence of the need for this kind of a critical study rather than the traditional analytic study are examples of this sort. Obvious misattributions, because based on strong historical evidence, you know, it's not conceivable that X said this or that Y said that. That's why I give you that as an example. Obviously, from a perspective of the system, it's not really important whether Rava is the person who said it, or whether or not Rebbe, for that matter, said it. What's important is that somebody of authority said it. What's important is that it's a logical possibility as an interpretation of a particular doctrine or the resolution of a particular problem. So that's one very broad area of things. If you talk about accuracy of transmission or problems in accuracy of transmission. But even as I say, even if it's not simply a question of an attribution to an individual, one could argue that there are, what about the possibility, for example, that a statement was taken out of a context, and that statement now has been, in the context in which it was interpreted, the wrong context, has now been given new meaning, and in light of that, when now confronted with another statement, a new conclusion has been reached as a result. In other words, the process has continued despite the error. Again, even if one were to assume that that's the case, I'll get to that in a moment, that's being very charitable. And it, although, again, it's certainly conceivable that such a thing could happen. It happens all the time. It's, again, very different to say that it happens once in a while, and that any system, no matter how tight, you know, contains a window for error. And to say that that reflects holes in the system or a problem with the system itself. That's number one. Number two, here one has to consider the possibility that because Torah Sheval Peh is not a B'di'evit, because this is the way in which we're supposed to have been approaching halakhic reality throughout history, that too becomes part of the system. Or to put it in a slightly different way, the very fact that something could be interpreted in a particular way makes it a valid possibility in terms of it being an accurate, or one of many accurate interpretations of a doctrine. Again, I refer not so much to specific details, but to doctrines, okay, principles, which obviously are the important issues. Whether or not a particular statement, whether or not the statement Palgina Dibure, let's say, when it was made by a particular Abtana or Amora, means either Palgina Nemanus, or literally Palgina Dibure, may not really be relevant. Those Rava or Abaya, when he said it, may have had one or the other in mind. But that doesn't invalidate the other interpretation, which, let's say, was which convinced, let's say, the Rashba or the Ramba. Even if we can prove historically that's not what Abaya meant by it, or Rava meant by it, you haven't necessarily proven that all the discussion of the Rashba and the Ramban, who assumed otherwise, was misleading and mistaken. On the contrary, because what's important in the process, and this is where Misora really, this is what I mean by Misora as a lechatchila, is the possibility for such inaccuracies, which in turn makes them no longer inaccuracies. What it means is that doctrines promulgated have a life of their own. They may have been suggested with a particular intent in mind and to resolve a particular problem, but the very fact that they can be applied in one way and are meant to be applied in one way does not invalidate the doctrine itself. and the possibility of its application in another area. And the whole notion of Masorah, the idea that we have a process, and that it's a human process, right, Lo B'Shamayim Hi, basically determines that whatever it is that we legitimately come up with is, or usually in any case is, a legitimate expression of the Torah. And as such, it becomes significant, intent notwithstanding. Rav Lichtenstein a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, gave a lecture here entitled Torah's Chesed and Torah's Emes. I don't know if any of you were here then, in which he discussed some of these issues. And again, this is a very, very famous and popular theme. The whole question of availability of Kim Chaim, to what extent one views that as a kind of b'di'eved. And all it means is that if you made a mistake and you were misled, but nonetheless came to the wrong conclusion, you get schar of Talmud Torah because, listen, you did your best, and all we can demand of you as a human being that you do your best. Is that the real meaning of these particular phrases? Or does it mean much more than that? Does it mean that there is no, this notion is incorrect, that intent, or one intent, or singular intent, is something which is insignificant in halakha, or original intent? What's important is legitimate interpretations, which then become an expression, a legitimate expression of Torah Shabbat. And that's really the notion of Shivan Panam Torah and Elel Elel Kim Chaim, at least the Summer Sharm understanding. Of course, the Ritvan Erevin being the most striking formulation. And this is, again, I said, there's a huge literature on this. The Ksos has, and his Akdama to the Ksos Koshin, big discussion about this. The Chatsiyara has a big tshuva about this. This question of what exactly is included in that idea, there is a huge literature on it. But again, the notion being that the system itself is intrinsically significant. And therefore, what the system does with a particular doctrine becomes more important than the narrow intent that original doctrine had. Yeah?
There is original intent, though, isn't there? I mean,
there may be original intent. No. Well, let me say two different things. If you talk about, here I would say the following. That's a very good question. Here, of course, one should distinguish probably between Torah Shebitzav and Torah Shemalpeh. When it comes to Torah Shebitzav, the notion of multiple truths or multiple meanings in a totally objective sense is a real possibility. Because after all, we're dealing with a text which is by definition divine and can be written in such a magical and mystical way. It can be true that the Torah itself has 70 different meanings, all of which are true. When it comes to, obviously, human statements, when it comes to issues of transmission, then, of course, we are dealing with a specific intent. If Rava said something and we're quoting it in Rava's name, he did mean something by it. There's no question about that. What I'm arguing, though, is that as far as we're concerned, as long as we proceed according to the laws dictated by the system itself and legitimized by the system, it no longer becomes important to us what Rava meant. It becomes important to us that there is such a concept on some level, and that perhaps this concept shares many possible applications. If Rava were here today, he may be convinced of one application or the other. But the fact that we're proceeding on a specific basis, even if Rava didn't mean it, even if Rava doesn't accept it, that doesn't mean that the other interpretation is incorrect. It may not have Rava's full backing now, but again, it doesn't mean that it's incorrect. So that, for example, in answer to the question, just to give another example, who wrote a particular work, and how significant is that? Whether it be works of Kabbalah or works of philosophy, etc. Was it written very early by Tanaim? Was it written late by Amoraim? Was it written by Gaonim, etc.? Or to the question, are certain parts of the Gemara perhaps authored by, not by Tanaim and Amoraim, but by Sabaraim? The answer that I would give is, generally the answer I would give, and I'll get to exceptions in a moment, is it makes no difference. Because as far as we're concerned, living in the 20th century, whether Rava said it, or whether Rabbi Chai Gaon interpreted it, or interpolated it into Rava, is really not of that much significance. Both are authority figures. And the very fact that an authority figure can accept a particular doctrine, from our perspective, gives it a certain validity. At least the validity of being a possible legitimate interpretation of Torah, which gives it the status of Talmud Torah. Yeah?
Isn't there like a hierarchy?
But there is a hierarchy. That's correct. So as far as the hierarchy, again, you know, since you raised the question, I was going to get to this later, but okay, we'll mention it now. There is a hierarchy, and that's why, for example, it should be pointed out that Rishonim themselves are sometimes sensitive to this problem. I mean, there are Rishonim, it's not only modern Talmud critics who say that some sugyas are Saboraic. There are Rishonim who say such things, and the modern Talmud critics are the first to tell you that. The problem is whether the fact that some Rishonim said it implies that they meant to say, therefore, that which is Saboraic is not to be treated as seriously. That's number one. Secondly, whether the fact that they said it with regard to 1 or 2% of the sugyas in Shas allows you, therefore, to take the license and assume that, you know, that the same notion can be applied anytime you have an anonymous sugya. Those are some of the problems with that. But the fact of the matter is that there are Rishonim who do say that certain sugyas are Saboraic. Now, they say that for two reasons. What motivated Rishonim to say this? I mean, Rishonim say, for example, the first sugya in Kiddushin and the first sugya in Bat Metzia, and there are sugyas here and there which they say are really lines of Rabbi Udaigon. Rabbi Udaigon wrote his parish on the Gemara. He wrote in a line, and the scribes who followed him incorporated that into the text of the Gemara. But what really motivated Rishonim to say that? Two things, generally. One is just simply the desire to explain kind of stylistic anomaly, what something is doing in a particular place, or why the Gemara seems to have kind of inane discussion of terminology sometimes where generally Gemaras deal with, you know, issues of substance. Why does it use this word and that word? Why Zakar? Why not Nekeva? Things like that. Things that stand out stylistically. So Rishonim are motivated to tell you that the reason that this looks different than a regular Gemara is because this, in fact, is not the Gemara. This is the musings of Rabbi Udaigon regarding the dikduk of the Gemara. So that's one motivation. The second motivation is to resolve a particular problem. And here, of course, is where you get into a sticky area. In other words, where there's a conflict of some sort, where a line, from the perspective of a Rishon, it stands out as being difficult, and by difficult, not because they don't like it, but because it appears to be obviously contradictory to other objective evidence of other Gemaras, something which requires some sort of resolution in one direction or another, some sort of reconciliation. If a Rishon has a Masorah, that line is a line of Rabbi Udaigon, or any other Gon, or Saboraic figure, he'll be able to tell you that indeed this is not as acute a contradiction as we had otherwise suspected. Because it may very well be that it's a problem for Rabbi Achaigon and Rabbi Udaigon to deal with. But per se, it's not a contradictory Gemara. That's where you get to the issue of hierarchy. So that in that kind of a situation, it is important to know who is saying where a line comes from and what its authority is. Now, if you have an irresolvable contradiction between what appears to be two Gemaras and you find out that it's not a Gemara, one of them is not a Gemara, it's a line of the Gaonim, then obviously the contradiction is no longer as acute. And if you were paskening halakha at that moment when it became obvious to you, unless you were convinced that Rabbi Achaigon had a very good resolution to the problem, or unless you were committed to Rabbi Achaigon as your authority figure in halakha, which may very well be, you would probably pasken in the other direction. So in that sense, the issue of hierarchy is very important. However, in 9 cases out of 10, from our perspective, that's not the case, and that's not the problem. Even if it turns out to have been a Rabbi Achaigon or a Rabbi Achaigon, if it was accepted by the Rishonim, and if on the basis of that line they resolved contradictions of the Gemara, apparently they took it seriously, and they considered it to be authoritative. And indeed, the very fact that Rabbi Achaigon stated it, presumably knowing the contradictory Gemara, would in and of itself be sufficient reason for us to believe that there was authority behind the statement. And therefore, it would behoove us to accept this as a legitimate expression of Torah Sheba'al Peh. From our perspective, when is it significant that a statement is the statement of Rabbi Achaigon or Achaigon, etc.? Possibly only in the area of Talmud Torah to resolve contradictions or basic problems in Rishonim themselves. In other words, if you have an unbelievably difficult position of the Rambam, which we're studying again from the perspective of theoretical Talmud Torah, mitzvah of Talmud Torah. And we're trying to figure out what it is that the Rambam means and how the Rambam, what conclusions we should reach from this difficult Rambam, which appears to be contradicting an explicit Gemara. If somebody comes along and shows us that it very well may be, but with either a Masora or very strong evidence, not simply a hypothesis without... you don't create this kind of hypothesis for that reason. But if you have other evidence which reinforces it, and somebody comes along and tells us, this happens to not be the Gemara, it happens to be Rabbi Chaigon, and we know that the Rambam either didn't have it in front of him, or, when it comes to the Gaonim at least, the Rambam often takes issue with interpretations of Gaonim, then of course that's very significant. You made a contribution in that sense to your Talmud Torah, because maybe it's inaccurate to try to interpret the Rambam or interpolate into the Rambam a very novel, very novel Kiddush in order to resolve the two. Especially if you have proof that the Rambam did not see. Or for example, in terms of yourselves, to take it a step further. How significant is it in determining precisely what Ksav Yad of particular Rishon had in front of it? The answer is, as a guessing game, and as a lechatchila approach to Talmud Torah, the answer probably is not very important. In other words, one's first approach when one is faced with a dilemma is not to assume that there's a problem with the Ksav Yad. On the other hand, we don't want to deny, if you're going to be intellectually honest and rigorous, you're not going to deny the fact that occasionally texts are transmitted corruptly. The proof of the pudding is that you can find one manuscript of a Ritva which reads one way and another which reads another way. Clearly one better than the other, or one reinforced by the Ramban, and the Meiri, and later Acharonim, etc., one not. And the conclusion obviously you're going to be able to reach is not to waste your time with that which is corrupt, but as much as possible you want to read the words of the Ritva and analyze the Ritva based on what he in fact said. In those kind of situations, the scholarly, so-called scholarly approach becomes very important. At the same time, is it often going to change doctrine in a fundamental way, or is it going to change halakha? The answer is, in 99% of the cases, it's not. Yeah?
But shouldn't our approach to Rishon be similar to the Gemara, that we're really not concerned about the original intent?
Yeah, that's the, well let me get, well no, I that's, again, if you ask a slightly different question, I think one has to distinguish, that's a good point, between two types of inaccuracies. The inaccuracy of a text, in the sense of, in other words, if the Ritva said usur, and the text reads mutter, okay, that's a dramatic example, obviously.
Wait,
incidentally, the text of Rishon, okay, which is very rare, but in the Gemara you'll never have it, almost never have it. You'll never have it in the Gemara. In a Rishon, you sometimes have. If you look at the printed Ritva on Makis, for example, or on Ksuvas, the old printed Ritva, and you compare it to the Shmuel Gobetz's Ritva, which is certainly much better, and to the now Moser Rav Kook, which is even much better than that, you'll see that there are some discrepancies which are incredible. I mean, a line is missing. A velo turned into an ella, which obviously has an opposite connotation. A putter turned into an asa. So obviously that kind of a glaring mistake, intent is important for that. If you're talking about a legitimate shita which appears only in the Ritva, but turns out to be a mistaken, factually mistaken in such a dramatic way, obviously intent is important. What I mean by intent not being important is, or not so important, is if the Ritva has a position on a sugya, a dramatic position, and we suggest alternative conceptual explanations for that position, and then the Ritva comes along and tells us what exactly he had in mind when he said it, their intent, I think, is far less important. Their doctrine, especially if the doctrine is, and generally speaking this is the case, the doctrine, initially at least, is created by the objective facts of the case, by contradictory Gemaras, by the intuitive reading of a line, etc. So that the Ritva may have come to his conclusion that, or the Ran may have come to his, or the Shidduch Vetz, the name of Rashi, may have come to his conclusion that Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua's argument about Bari V'Shema applies equally to Shema V'Shema. He probably came to that conclusion because a certain line in Rashi struck him intuitively, as meaning that, or the evidence of the Gemara, as you saw it, meant that. Now, whether he had in mind that what the explanation for that is X, or Y, or Z, I think that becomes irrelevant. Because the very fact that he believes that to be, assuming that we accept his authority, a legitimate interpretation, and a legitimate shita, then creates an independent reality, namely the existence of the shita as a significant interpretation of Torah Shabbat Peh, one which we then are obligated, from our own perspective, to analyze, and analyze to the best of our ability, and even possibly to take issue with the original intent of the person who promulgates the doctrine. So that's what I'm saying. So you have to distinguish, in that sense, between accuracy of transmission in terms of the facts of the case, what it is the man said, and what it is he had in mind for the doctrine that he suggested, even though he may have come to that doctrine even without that particular intent. Yeah.
But I thought, why should our, just like in Gemara, we're really not so concerned what exactly Rav said, it's how Rav has been interpreted. Why don't we do that?
Well, in the sense of authority figures. I say that's true if it's been picked up by other authority figures. And the fact that it's made it to the Gemara and the Rishonim have accepted it, and accepted it without question and have treated it as if it's a significant part of Torah Shabbat, then, right, that's what gives that validity to it. If you're talking about a mistaken text of a Rishon,
let's say the Rishon has been, let's say, around the top, and the Nesuk Quran has accepted that.
Text itself, and it turns out to be incorrect.
It turns out to be
I would say that as a Rambam, it no longer has the same force. If you can objectively prove 100% that it's incorrect, in terms of it being the Rambam, or it would be inaccurate to continue to quote that as a Rambam. But I think it would be significant in terms of some of the conclusions, maybe that Rishonim, other Rishonim and Akronim have reached as a result of their attempt to grapple with the Rambam.
So why don't we have the same attitude for tomorrow also?
I think we do.
Well, let's say it could be proven that it wasn't Rav's statement.
If you prove, that's exactly what I said before. If you can be proven that it wasn't Rav's statement, and you have a problem with the Rambam who appears to deny it.
Yeah, besides the Rambam, why can we call this Rav now?
Well, if we have 100% objective proof that it's incorrect as Rav, then maybe we should quote it as Rabbi Yochanan's understanding of, well, not Rabbi Yochanan, because that's going back in history, let's say it as the Gaonim's understanding of a position in the Gemara, which has been inaccurately quoted as Rabbah, but in fact as somebody. And again, when you're talking about Gemara, we're not talking about the text as much as the transmission of there is a fundamental difference, but I'm talking about the text of a Ritva, which has come down to us in written form, and the Potter should have been an Asur. That's a very different case than the line of transmission of the Gemara, of the Torah Shabbat Peh and Masorah transmission of a particular doctrine, Baal Peh, right? Which they have in the name of Rabbah, which we now have objective evidence he never could have said.
Let's say we have,
but somebody did say it.
Let's say we have objective evidence that was totally taken out of context. So
if you have objective evidence that was totally taken out of context, then it's more problematic. But then I would say you have to rely on the fact. See, you're never going to be able to prove that 100%. That's my next point. The problem with that kind of situation, it would be a problem if it was 100% provable. But what you have is, basically, and this is a critique from a purely scholarly level, on this kind of pursuit, is you basically have an internal criteria only. Right? It's a pursuit which has no outside controls. Which creates some of the dangers of it as well, which I want to get to in a moment. There is no way you're ever going to prove. You can prove that a statement was made in a particular context, and consequently it might be called into question whether or not its transference to another context is, let's say, logically mandated. You can prove that. But you're almost never going to be able to prove that it was absolutely unjustified. Now, you can call it into question, but you're almost never going to prove that it didn't also mean the statement itself, beyond the context in which it's going to be applied. And since you're never going to have objective outside evidence that's going to be decisive in that regard, that's where Masorah comes into play. That's where the notion that we do rely on Masorah, and that we assume, unless the evidence is overwhelming otherwise, that transmission is accurate. And it's going to be very rare that you're going to find overwhelming evidence to the contrary. That's where that comes into play, and that's where I think you have to assume accuracy, if not of the individual citation, of the legitimacy of the doctrine. And therefore, of it having been legitimately through the system, been proven to be a legitimate expression of Darshan Lopet. That's very different than when you're already in an era, in a much later era. It's not in the time of the Gemara, but the time of Rishonim, where we're dealing with texts, written fixed texts, and something has been transmitted because of scribal error, clearly, because now you found the other, because either doesn't make it clear, for whatever reason, assuming again you can prove it. There it's obviously more provable than the time of Chachmei Gemara and even Chachmei Hagaonim. From the time of Rishon Haman, it's more provable, right, whether something is an inaccurate transmission or not. There, I think you have the right to say that if you can prove it, that it's no longer the Ramban speaking, but the Rambam speaking. Although I still will argue that it's the doctrine created by its analysis may still be significant. The fact that Reb Chaim, for example, came up, you know, it's the old question about the Rambam, you know, the famous joke. You know, is this any way to answer a difficult Rambam? The fact that the Rambam himself, may have had something else in mind, does not per se disqualify Reb Chaim's interpretation of the Rambam. Because Reb Chaim's interpretation of the Rambam may have been motivated by the problem of the Rambam, but we presume, and in 9 cases out of 10 I can prove it to you, at least in a general sense, that its roots are not only in the Rambam. The Rambam spurred... In terms of whether it should have been motivated by this particular Rambam, because the Rambam now has been proven to have a different gear. For example, what we said, just to give you a local example, the Rambam's position on Chazi Lechi Medaraisa, in Iksuba. There is some discussion whether or not that's whether the Rambam has a gear, so doesn't have that gear. So I point out, Frankel Rambam points out the different kisvei out of the Rambam. Some have it, some don't. But I must say that I didn't hesitate, in the least, to discuss, and probably the Rove manuscripts, I think Frankel says, do not have it. But personally, I didn't hesitate in the least to draw a conclusion based on the possibility that the Rambam does have that here. And it wouldn't bother me in the least if tomorrow it turned out proof positive that he definitely didn't have the here. Again, I wouldn't base my suggestion that this is the Rambam Shita on this particular fact. But that it highlights but the possibility of a person who believes, let's say, Ksuba being Drabana, and yet with that terminology of Chazi Lechi Medaraisa, that possibility is something which is significant, even if it's wrong for the Rambam. And the same thing can be said, I think, for every single Reb Chaim, practically every single. I would say every single Reb Chaim. Or not just Reb Chaim, obviously, any of these kinds of interpretations, the Gugulim, that take place after the fact as well. You cannot work in a vacuum. You always have to work with reference to concepts, and the way in which those concepts are played out in different texts, whether it be Gemaras, Rishonim, Midrashim, etc. And if you're spurred, even on the basis of a false reading or a fallacious reading, nonetheless, who's to say that you haven't, in the course of things, come up with things which are accurate? And who's to say that Hashgacha hasn't played a role, if I may add that in as well, you know, in leading you in this direction on that basis. Again, I'm not saying that it's always Hashgacha. I'm just saying it's such a possibility, the notion of Parashat Baal Peh, the notion of Mesora is such that that's a possibility as well. The reason that we can rely on it is because, since this is the L'chatchila way in which Torah is supposed to be transmitted, the assumption can be made that we're not going to be steered very wrong. The assumption can be made that if there is a particular criteria, there is a particular methodology in reaching halacha l'maisa, for example, or in deriving conceptual conclusions from the Gemara, that the safeguards of that are built in on some, on a philosophical level. As long as you are sincere and you're trying to be as objective and as rigorous as possible, that you have the right to assume a certain level, a certain element of siyata d'shamayim. But that doesn't mean, again, that's no substitute for rigor. It's not supposed to be a substitute for rigor. But the two working in tandem, I think, are represent something that should not be taken lightly. The Chazon Ish has a very famous discussion in his Sfarim about this whole notion of Ashkaka. I don't mean to go so far as he does, although how far he went itself is the matter of some controversy. Anybody's interested, there was an interesting, very interesting exchange a few years ago in tradition. Somebody from Cleveland, Tzvi A. Yehuda, I think is his name. You're Cleveland, yeah. Tzvi A. Yehuda wrote an article about Chazon Ish's attitude towards these issues. And Professor Lyman wrote a response, wrote a rejoinder to that. Very interesting. So anybody who's interested in that should check into that. Exactly what the Chazon Ish did or didn't say, number one, how far you take this notion of Hashkafa. In other words, what will happen? He does this question, something similar to this question, in other words. If it turns out that, he extends it to Tarshabat Sav as well as Tarshabat Peh, which is probably problematic. What will happen, for example, if tomorrow you find the first Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu, that you find Moshe Rabbeinu's Sefer Torah, and you compare it to our Sefer Torah, and you find all sorts of inaccuracies and mistakes, etc. What will happen? So he suggests in the name of the Chazon Ish, it doesn't make a difference. What Torah is, what Torah has become. And that one of the main reasons for that is this idea that Hashgacha has protected what Torah has become. The Solomon argued that that's true, but only to an extent. First of all, to say that about Torah Shebichsav is very difficult, because Torah Shebichsav, again, for the same reason that it's more flexible in terms of understanding the possibility of more than one valid interpretation, because it is a divine text, that same reason will determine that discussion of it evolving in some way, even through Hashgacha, is extremely problematic. If the text is divine and magical and mystical, and for that reason can contain more than one meaning, then it stands to reason, and the words themselves have Kedusha, and the letters themselves have Kedusha, then the possibility of it evolving, even within halakhic, halakhically accepted transmission, is extremely problematic. It certainly creates a philosophical problem. That's the first point that he made. Although, again, it is a problem. Either way, it's a problem. The second point that he made is that perhaps one should distinguish between Safek and Vada. It's one thing to say, even with regard to Tarsha Baal Peh, that we have a right to assume, and again, as I say, not simply as a B'diyam, but as a Chathila, that the Masorah is accurate, because that is the essence of what we are and what we have. And it's wrong to be critical in that sense, and that's what I meant at the outset, about challenging the framework, as opposed to working within the framework and then being rigorous within a context. It's an inappropriate approach for one to be critical with regard to the Masorah, to assume that a statement made in the Gemara should be questioned in terms of the validity of its transmission. And yet, if for some reason there is an objective dilemma, not that you're looking for, but one which presents itself, and where the evidence is an overwhelming and reinforcing in a particular direction, then of course, to be intellectually honest, one has to concede the possibility that indeed it is a Rava, maybe it is Rebbe instead of Rava. Or in the case of the Ritva, that if there are other Kisoyam, the same Mutter instead of Asar, that certainly one has to reevaluate the Ritva in that light. But that's one thing. When it still remains a suffix and a question of how probable is it or isn't it, there perhaps the notion that Hashgacha may play some role in terms of keeping our Masorah pure, that's one thing. But where you deal with Vadai, where you know for a fact that a mistake has been made, like I when I said the name of the Ritva. In fact, the scribe wrote Mutter instead of Usser, and we're now confronted with it. We want to know, is this the Ritva or is it not? And it makes a difference, because both in terms of authority and in terms of, for example, contradiction. Should I take this Ritva, compare it to another Ritva and another Masechta, which appears to contradict it and create a new doctrine on the basis of that? Or should I say, listen, the preponderance of evidence dictates that the text in front of me is simply wrong, that the other Ksaviyat is the correct one, that the two Ritvas are consistent, and there's no justification for me to create a new Chiddush on the basis of this analysis. In such a situation, to say that because the scribe did it this way, that's Hashgacha, when it's a Badai, that's what Professor Lyman argued, that takes even that Chazon Ish too far. But again, these are very complicated and delicate issues. Again, I want to emphasize what they are. And the question of quantity and where you draw the line often is critical. Yeah, it is often critical. I'm only speaking in a general sense. Yeah.
From a logic standpoint, how do you draw the line? In other words, you said that if we have a suffix, then we automatically assume that the story has been true and we interpret it correctly. Right. But even if we find out afterwards that it's been wrong, logically we won't change anything because it doesn't matter. Because what's fact, it doesn't matter. So what
the fact that it's been accepted, and the fact, again, I'm dealing with a situation where somehow the doctrine itself, in other words, if you can prove to me that something is totally fallacious, totally wrong, without any kind of justification, makes no sense in the form in which it has come down to us, and is all based on one mistake, on a very big, huge mistake and hoax, then you would have a big problem. Then the question, the halakhic process has now validated this unknowingly, that's a very big problem. And there you have to decide whether or not that really become, that's really this issue that I just mentioned that they argue about, really comes into play. Do we rewrite halakha now in light of this fact, not no longer a theory, even a strong theory, but in light of this fact, or do we leave it as is and say that Hashgacha has determined that this should be halakha because it's allowed this to happen? I think that's a very big problem. I don't think that there's an easy, it would be very easy for me to say to you, that's it, there's nothing to discuss. I don't know. I really don't know what I think you have to consider that as a possibility. But I will say that that can almost never happen. And you're probably never going to have such a situation for the reason that I mentioned before. First of all, because we believe that the Masori is accurate. And there really are very few instances where you have such a dramatic mistake in transmission. Even the ones that appear to be mistakes in transmission, as I say, are usually ones of attribution rather than transmission per se. And even if there are mistakes in transmission, even if you can prove it, it's still far away from proving that this is not a legitimate idea, one which may yet be true, and therefore authority of this particular individual aside, somebody else's authority is giving it validation. And the fact that it's caused us to reevaluate the text and the problems, etc., and come up with something in light of that may in fact be true, even if the premise which motivated us initially was incorrect. If you can find something which denies all those possibilities and is so dramatic, then I think you'd have a problem. That's finding Torah's Moshe today with mistakes, both because of its Torah Shebichtav, and even from the other perspective, would be a major, major problem, and I really don't know what the solution would be. I would be interested to see how people would handle it. But I can see it going either way from from that perspective. But to find something so dramatic is not only rare, it's probably non-existent. In terms of what we do have, in terms of something being so clear-cut, and not having these other options for explanation, that I don't think you have it. I don't think you have such dramatic evidence. And I think to suggest, because you may have errors of technical transmission or attribution, that these kind of errors have crept in as well, that I think is a major point of difference between people who are absolutely committed to this kind of a venture, and what I think has to be people who are committed to Talmud Torah in its classical sense, which I think is a religious imperative, which denies that, or at least which initially doesn't challenge, doesn't make those sort of challenges. Okay, so that's the idea. Okay, that's one element of this. Again, I'm skipping around to respond to your questions, and I'm not presenting this in any kind of exhaustive way, but just touching on some of the issues. In another sense, though, it should be clear, just to add to this point, the idea then that there's a Masora not only of detail and of fact, but a Masora of methodology is, I think, very important. This is something that the Rav certainly has a number of occasions mentioned, without going into detail in terms of proof, but I think it's something which my point of view simply is the corollary of the previous point. The idea of Nisara and the Torah Shabbat Peh is a l'chatchila. And the nature of what Talmud Torah is, and why it is considered to be the most important pursuit that we have, why is Avodas Hashem par excellence, the idea that a cognitive intellectual pursuit can be Avodas Hashem, per se implies this as well, the idea that not only what we have, but the way in which we approach it, namely the classical methodologies of Talmud Torah, which are that of analysis, the assumption of accurate transmission, and then the analysis and the attempt to break down conceptually what it is that's going on and what that implies to us and what the significance of that is in terms of creating some sort of worldview, that is also implicit in the notion of the Sora. That this, in fact, is the way, we assume that this is the way people have always learned. And since this is the way they've always learned, in other words, we assume that Talmud Torah is not something which has evolved in that sense. Details may have evolved. We may have conceptually honed and sharpened, from our perspective, certain doctrines, etc. But Talmud Torah has always been not only an, but the integral Avodas Hashem. Issues of Bari Hashem and Bari Adif have been debated from time immemorial, because that's important. We view that to be spiritually important. Okay, why that's spiritually important is a different issue. But we certainly view it as being spiritually important. Somehow we view this as creating for us a world view, an outlook. What the Rav in Ish Halacha, in the Madon Echmidon, and other places, but primarily in those places, depicts as a kind of ideal worldview, which parallels, but only in an ideal sense, the real world. That's the ideal counterpart of the real world. But a system which is self-sufficient and independent and not subject necessarily to the scrutiny of the real world. That notion per se implies that the methodology, the way in which we approach these details, is of utmost significance. And whether we have, let's say, a historical or a textual approach or an analytic, rigorous conceptual approach, is of course the difference between it creates many differences, but in a certain sense creates or highlights the difference between Talmud Torah as simply a way of life or Talmud Torah as representing an ideal system and a conceptual a system of values. So that the idea that at least the Chachilah, when we approach a Gemara, we approach it in its traditionally and historically the way in which others have approached it, rather than initially challenging the facts as transmitted and only then trying to figure out what it is that these facts, once submitted to this different kind of analysis, tell us and impose upon us, is again a very important point of departure between the two. Beyond that, I think the point should be made that a textual approach, or this, obviously I'm speaking more about Talmud than I am, Talmud criticism more than I am of other kinds of strata, let's say those different areas, but this is perhaps the most sensitive issue, so that's what I want to, that's what I'm focusing on. I think it should be noted that there are several other problems as well that one has to confront. The first is psychological. Okay. Again, one should be aware of the fact that when one comes with a perspective not of submission, assumption of accuracy and attempt to deal with it, with what we have in front of us, without in any way casting any kind of challenge to that which has been transmitted, psychologically that's very different than if one's perspective is a critical one in terms of encountering the material. Obviously, the question of reverence and rather than respect and submission is very much undermined if one believes that what he has in front of him is not a legitimate Nisara, but possible legitimate Nisara. And that at least the Chachila, one stance is critical in the sense of challenging what has been for the last, let's say, 1,000 or 2,000 years assumed. And that should not be minimized either. It's a practical, it's a pragmatic consideration, not a, not an intrinsic one, not a philosophical one. but it's one which has a certain amount of importance to it. Again, if Talmud Torah is not simply a game, and it obviously is not, if it's the way in which man traverses the gulf to the divine, which otherwise is almost unbridgeable, and for us that's why we consider Talmud Torah to be the greatest gift that we have, because it is divinely ordained, divinely revealed path for man to overcome, you know, the most essential theological obstacle, namely the ability for finite man to reach out to infinite God. If we believe that that's what it is, then a perspective of respect and awe and submission is also a prerequisite. And therefore the psychological stance is an important one as well. But it goes beyond that. It's not simply a pragmatic consideration. Particularly if you're an adherent of the methodology of Brisk, but even if not, I'd say it's more accented in Brisk than it is in other places. One has to realize that the significance of Talmud Torah, and precisely because it is a divinely revealed path to Avodas Hashem, by definition, demands submission. The Rav often points out, for example, that the Rambam, when he talks about Talmud Torah, talks about it in terms also of Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shamayim. What does Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shamayim have to do with Talmud Torah? The recognition that we don't analyze Gemara and Rishonim and Halacha from our perspective. Again, a critical stance. Here and now, I'm not talking about a critical stance in terms of relating details, etc., which I was referring to before, but in terms of the way in which we are impressed by and our posture to towards Talmud Torah. Do we look at it critically in the sense that we have our logical perspective and we make Talmud Torah fit to that logical perspective? Or are we willing to admit that Torah is a discipline in and of itself? And as such, that's where the Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shamayim comes in. One which often requires of us that we suspend human logic or personal logic. And instead attempt, let's say, to describe rather than to describe and to define, let's say, rather than to give reasons for to understand it. In Brisk, as I say, that notion is particularly acute, because in Brisk and Derek, we have a very strong emphasis, accent, on formalistic categories, which do not necessarily correspond with normal human logic, which is not to say that it's illogical, on the contrary. It's definitely not illogical. And obviously, rigor and analysis and precision is perhaps more important, classification and definition is more important for Brisk than it is for any other or approach to learning. But it's precisely that. It's the idea that you're trying to describe and to capture as accurately as possible a phenomenon, even if that phenomenon per se does not correspond to normal logical reality. Right, the whole idea that there can be a shame this and a shame that, shame meaning, again, formal category, as opposed to the normal rules which would regulate such a category from a human perspective. That formalistic bent demands of us that we suspend human logic often. And it's for that reason as well that the notion of a Masorah, not only of detail, but of methodology, and the notion that one cannot be totally critical in terms of challenging the structure rather than the challenging from within the structure. Again, that becomes a notion which becomes central to Talmud Torah. For example, if you look at, again, to get back to the example of Talmud criticism, what motivates the idea that a particular text, let's say, may not, in fact, be accurately transmitted? Often what may motivate it, as I say, for Rishonim, what motivated it is either stylistic or substantive difficulty, contradiction, etc. And indeed, this is often a motivation which should be looked at. Again, without arguing that it makes that much difference whether Rabbi Chaigon is the author or a rabbi, as I outlined here earlier. But the other point is, how do you decide whether it's 5% or whether it's 35, 40, or 60%, the criterion often used is that of human logic. Right? If a particular application doesn't seem sensible, or it doesn't seem consistent with a, you know, some sort of general viewpoint. Then the question should be raised, perhaps our transmission is inadequate. If you look at the literature of scholars who are written in this field, that's often what it is that motivates the inquiry. And again, it could be sincerely motivated, I don't deny. I just say that from a traditional perspective, from our perspective, from the perspective of B'nai Torah, that should be examined. That's not, again, the point should be made that human logic and the logic of Torah do not necessarily have to be hava hatalia. They do not necessarily have to conform. And on the contrary, they probably should not conform. What makes this divine law rather than human law, and what makes it kind of law which is not going to be abrogated at any point and not subject to historical circumstances is precisely the fact that we believe that it's that there's a divine element to it. Whether it's a mystical element or it's a historical element, it doesn't really make a difference. Whether the system works to the betterment of, you know, most of the individuals and most of the times, as the Rambam explains, or the system magically adapts internally to every situation, as some mystics would have you believe, is really irrelevant. But the fact is there is this divine element to halakha and to halakha as a system, which requires of us that we suspend sometimes human logic, and which therefore does not allow us the luxury of challenging the Masara simply on the basis of logical inaccurate, what appears on the surface at least, to be inconsistencies derived from logical. Yeah.
Out of curiosity, don't we say things like that, I mean at least some of the Rishonim say that God cannot be something that we cannot logically think?
You mean absurdities? You're talking about the famous, the picking up of the, can God create, pick up the...
Right.
Yeah, that's, I mean, Rav Saad Yagon already says, and that's obvious, that, Rav Saad Yagon really says two things. Number one, I don't know if this necessarily, but this doesn't really relate to, I don't see how this relates to this question per se, but I think it's a very important issue. Rav Saad Yagon really makes two points in Emunah Sadeus. Number one, in terms of philosophical inquiry, that's really not what I'm discussing, but in terms of philosophical inquiry, where does one draw the line? What questions are valid and what questions are invalid? Rav Saad Yagon says you can, the question, what is the significance of a particular phenomenon, that's a valid question from the perspective of Jewish philosophy. The question, why could the same thing not have been accomplished in an alternative manner, in other words, the purpose of Kilayim is X, Y, and Z. Say, what is the purpose of Kilayim? To try to figure it out, that's legitimate. To say, once you figured it out, why HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't accomplish X, Y, and Z, not by means of Kilayim, but by means of hocus pocus, that's the question which goes beyond legitimate. Because there's no end to it there. You have to draw the line somewhere. That's number one. Number two, questions which imply, where the question itself implies an internal contradiction, that's not a question. That is an absurdity. He doesn't use this formulation, obviously. This is what he is obviously what he means. The question, how can an omnipotent God create something that he himself cannot lift? The old, whatever it is, I don't know how old that is, but that's a question, obviously, which goes way back, ancient times. Rav Saad Yagon said that's an absurdity. It's not a legitimate question. It's not a question without an answer. It's just an absurdity. The question itself implies a contradiction in terms. But that's an important question. What are the parameters of legitimate philosophical, and here we're discussing halakhic inquiry in terms of challenging, etc.
Yeah, but I was just saying, even within the halakhic framework itself, when they have to create something that logical to...
Yeah, no, that's what I say. I mean, obviously logic, that's clear. That logic and that rigor and that analysis are crucial to Talmud Torah. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, that's, again, the intellectual, cognitive emphasis in Talmud Torah demands that of us. And again, that makes us unique in the history of religion. But as I said at the outset, you have to create, it has to be within a framework, because if you don't have that framework, there is no starting point for any discipline, number one. For divine discipline, surely. And for a divine discipline based on the concept of Masara, absolutely. And therefore, it's just a question of drawing the line. I mean, obviously, within halakha, we do not abide contradictions. But not abiding contradictions and attempting to reconcile potential difficulties within reason, those are two different statements. Initially, at least, we try to resolve everything. You know, that's the famous, if you take a minute, you know, if you just, the phenomenology of resolving problems is to confront the sources, initially at least to try to resolve them, and at some point to determine if logically there is no resolution, either that's, that two different people have said them, that they refer to two different situations, or that indeed they contradict each other and one is right and one is wrong. And those are the options that you always have in front of you. Which one you choose in a particular instance always depends on the, you know, on the inner dynamics of that that particular case.
Yeah, but when you say that you're suspending human logic for the divine logic of,
right.
So, I mean,
I just mean that initially, at least, you have to be aware of the fact that you are not the arbiter. Like, for example, in terms of should human logic play, how much of a role should human logic play in determining that there's a problem here, such that we should challenge the accuracy of our transmission? Should we look for Rabbi Daigon behind this difficult line of the Gemara? Or, let's put it a different way, in light of what I said before. Should we look at Rav Yudaigon behind this difficult line of the Gemara in our analysis of the Rambam who appears to reject him, or not? Or should we assume on the contrary, that there is a that there's a way out even for the Rambam, but a way out simply which requires a more precise, even if also a more formal and less purely logical definition? Again, not meaning anti-logical, but logical in the sense of conforming to what we normally would believe. Should we do that or not? Initially, and how quickly we should do that? The answer is, one has to always have in the back of his mind the, and maybe not just in the back of his mind, maybe in the front of his mind, the possibility that indeed we are dealing with a very formalistic category. And then indeed the Rambam does have something in mind. And the answer is not so pat as to simply say he doesn't have this or that text, and therefore is not, there's no problem here. That's what I mean by that. Again, where you draw the line depends on each individual case. Obviously, there's no one answer to that question. It depends on the preponderance of the evidence. Obviously, intellectual honesty is crucial. This is not a game. I'm just saying that the problem of an initially, at least, a critical stance or a critical methodology rather than a traditional methodology to a Talmud Torah is that it is largely based on the idea that things run according to human logic. And that certainly is not the case, always. And to limit it to that would be to cut out not only details, but to rob us of that which is, you know, kind of one of the most spiritually significant parts of Talmud Torah. It's divine anger, which is not only reflected in Tzeiras HaKasuv, but also sometimes even in, you know, in the more mishpatim-like areas in formalistic categories of thought as well. Okay. So that's something else which should be considered as well. Alright, I have to, again, I have more to say about this, but we'll have to stop here. I have to say, at the same time, obviously, basically what I'm suggesting then is that, obviously, in terms of a methodology of Talmud Torah, one has to be very committed to that which has been, that's just, you know, time immemorial been the methodology of Talmud Torah. And then at least initially one has to be skeptical about the extent to which the historical school of Talmud study is going to either be valid, accurate, and certainly going to be valuable under most circumstances. Certainly as a replacement, some people are suggesting, and recently there's a spate of articles about this as a replacement, this the argument being based on the notion of intellectual honesty, that this should now replace the historical attempt to, in other words, to determine precisely the strata of the Gemara and to analyze things on that basis, that should replace traditional Talmud Torah. It's certainly something which is unacceptable, I think, from our perspective. If for no other reason, but for the reasons that I obviously outlined, and there are a number of them, and obviously they touch on major, you know, areas of Ashkafa and religious commitment. But beyond that, I think it should be pointed out as well that it really changes the entire focus of Talmud Torah. That approach changes the entire focus of Talmud Torah from a conceptual and divine one, really, to a human one. Because if the focus of Talmud Torah is to determine who said what, when, and whether or not it was accurately transmitted, obviously you're engaged in a completely different type of endeavor. Beyond the psychological problem, beyond the problem I just mentioned, and beyond the problem I mentioned previously, just in terms of what it is, how valuable what you're doing is from a spiritual perspective, obviously you're just engaged in a different direction, completely different kind of pursuit. Whether or not that kind of pursuit requires a, even if it's accurate incidentally, even if it's not damaging, even if it contributes, whether or not that particular technical pursuit requires a birkas ha-Torah or not is probably highly questionable. Even in situations where it's accurate and where, as I say, where it contributes. Simply because that's simply not what we define as Talmud Torah. Talmud Torah is Avodas Hashem, is not trying to figure out who lived where and when, and who first made the statement, who took it next, what they did with it, etc. If it contributes somehow, by breaking it up to understanding the logical, let's say, assumptions of a doctrine, that's something else. But Talmud Torah means engaging the divine, or engaging the divine word. And engaging the divine word and engaging the text of the divine word, right, with the emphasis being on the text, are really two different things. That's something that should be pointed out as well. At the same time, I don't want to leave you with a completely critical perspective. I think on balance, one should say that there are obviously situations in which this is a legitimate pursuit. As I say, there's no question about it. There's no question that the Rishonim themselves were sensitive sometimes to inaccuracies of the Rishonim was sometimes pointed out that Ravasi says this in the name of that person, really he didn't say it, really he heard it from him, he misunderstood it. There are such precedents in Rishonim and in Ephraim. There are Gemaras which are Samaraic, there's no question about that. To conclude from there that all of them are, and to use that as a weapon to open up the Gemara to more critical inquiry may be something which is not desirable. But that there exist Gemaras which are Samaraic is something which is true. And that may be important either in terms of authority or in terms of accuracy of understanding other Rishonim in light of that is again something which should it should be pointed out, which is not only legitimate, but sometimes very valuable. It can save you, you know, often a lot of wasted time. It can improve your perspective on certain issues. And it can prevent you from further inaccuracies. So that when something is clear-cut, when the proof is the preponderance of proof is very strong, and you're not involved in the kind of religious problems entailed in challenge of the Masorah, etc., then of course this kind of thing can be very valuable. Again, I don't think it constitutes per se, or spending hours and hours pursuing it constitutes the Talmud Torah or the kind of Talmud Torah that that you have when you're trying to figure out the nature of Bari B'Shema. But it is something which can facilitate, which can improve your understanding. And the same thing is true, incidentally, for knowledge of the history of different Amoraim and Tanaim, and certainly of Rishonim and Achronim. To know where they lived and what kind of things they were involved in, and to know who knew who and who was influenced by who, these can be very valuable. Again, I think that per se, the study of that, and incidentally it's a study which I myself am committed to, I think it's important and I do it. I think it's important, but again, I don't think it's Talmud Torah. I think it's important as an ancillary, or as an auxiliary to Talmud Torah, I think it's important. In the sense, again, that you know where to look, if you have a difficult Haggadot Maimonides, it's important to know that if you look at the Mordecai, you might find another reflection of it. If you look at the Rav Yoh and the Ravon, it might appear there. It's important to know that. If you don't know the relationship between people and schools of halakha, you won't know that. It's important to know the methodology of Balei HaTosfos, on the surface at least, in terms of as an initial approach in any case, is different from that of Rashi and that of the pre-Balei HaTosfos period. It's important to know that there are different methodologies of learning, whether it be Pekias and Iyun or Pilpul and analysis or analysis and analogy, or whatever it may be. It's important to know those things because knowledge of them heightens your ability to analyze substantively issues, where to pursue them, to know where to look, to know how to look at them. even historically, how a doctrine develops is sometimes important to know. Again, in terms of tracing how it is that it came about, you can often is often the best way to get at its root, its core. So things there is much to be gained, not so much by textual criticism, I don't think, but even now and again by textual criticism, as I say, to resolve a particular type of problem as an aid to, rather than as a substitute for, or a challenge of, there is something to be gained. And certainly the other areas of historical motifs, biographical, intellectual, historical, where a person comes from, what kind of society he lived in, what kind of issues he's grappling with, why an issue comes about at a certain time and not at another time, what kind of conceptions are floating around in a society such that a particular Rishon has it in the back of his mind when he brings it to his study of Gemara, and therefore may come to a conclusion that somebody else didn't reach. Again, that's a very touchy issue. I'm just mentioning it as an example, but obviously something that requires treatment in and of itself, a question of influence. Again, not conscious, pragmatic, artificial influence, but unconscious, legitimate influence. A person being the sum of what he is and where he has been, and bringing the, you know, the sum total of his talents to a particular discipline. That notion, which is perfectly legitimate, it might be important to know what it is that he was exposed to, so we can better understand why it is that he, as opposed to somebody else, has reached this conclusion. Although the conclusion once reached, for reasons that I cited earlier, now takes on a life of its own, becomes part of the Masorah, as long as it's legitimately arrived at and is a possible expression of Torah Sheba'al Peh, now our analysis of it, of course, is independent of its original context. That's something to remember as well. So these things can be a tremendous aid, and Chacham Yisrael in general can be a tremendous aid. The issue then becomes, obviously, one of perspective. What is dominant and what is, what has to be viewed in light of it is obviously the key issue. To know that something is fundamental to Talmud Torah while something else is an aid to Talmud Torah, to know that as appealing sometimes as it may be, one should be critical about being critical is also an important thing to know. And finally, that one should think one should be, one's dominant perspective should be one of aggressive commitment and adherence to the tradition in this respect. Again, not as a not just because it's better to be conservative than to be bold and radical. That's not what I mean at all. Just because that seems to be the nature of what Talmud Torah should be. The idea that Masorah, again, the concept of Masorah is a lachapila. And the idea that something which should be aggressively affirmed, something which should be protected and preserved, has probably, which incidentally has always been the posture, it appears, has always been the posture of Bali Allah throughout the generation. And it's that posture which basically ensures accuracy and continuity. That's something which should mark us all. That's something that I think one has no right to compromise on. To compromise on that is really to call into question one's loyalty to the purpose of Talmud Torah. All right, I'm going to stop here. There are some other things I wanted to discuss, but maybe we'll have another opportunity. And if you want to ask any questions, I'll make other opportunities for that. Sunday we're at 10 o'clock because of solidarity.
Correct? Yeah.